Hello and welcome back to the Electronic Intifada podcast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. We continue our focus on the health catastrophe in Gaza and the backlash against doctors and healthcare providers in the US for speaking out against the genocide. In January, Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights released a report examining the, quote, near total disruption of maternal healthcare directly caused by Israel's destruction of hospitals, clinics, and pharmacies, compounded by the lack of medical supplies, equipment, and electricity. Women, the group writes, especially pregnant and nursing mothers, are deprived of critical antenatal, postnatal, and obstetric care, as well as essential nutritional support and hygiene products, putting their lives at grave risk. Over the last 18 months, and especially since Israel closed the crossings in early March, banning the entry of necessary medications, medical equipment, fuel, and food, the levels of catastrophic malnutrition on pregnant and postpartum women and their newborns have risen sharply. Joining us to talk about all of this is Bridget Rochios. Bridget is a certified nurse midwife and reproductive health nurse practitioner. After months of seeing the genocide unfold in Gaza, including the systemic and systematic destruction of the Palestinian healthcare system and the targeted killings of healthcare workers, Bridget felt called to go to Gaza to support and stand in solidarity with her Palestinian colleagues. In May 2024, Bridget volunteered at the Emirati Maternity Hospital in Rafah through the Canadian-based medical solidarity organization GLIA. In the U.S., Bridget worked at the UCSF Medical Center in San Francisco and was targeted for suspension after she returned from Gaza last year. After 9 months of being on administrative leave, UCSF has issued a notice of intent to fire her for refusing to remove a watermelon pin on her badge. Bridget, thank you so much for being with us today on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I want to get into the situation with you at UCSF in a few minutes, but first, let's talk about the work that you did in Gaza and your assessment of the medical catastrophe right now, 7 weeks into the total siege on Gaza, as hospitals, medical clinics, and practitioners themselves continue to be attacked by Israel.
It's kind of hard to even imagine the circumstances at this point because of how belligerent the violence and occupation has been and how specific the targeting has been on healthcare workers in hospitals. When I was there nearly a year ago now, this situation was in a beyond catastrophic state. When I arrived to Rafah at Emirati Hospital, Nasser Hospital had just been essentially destroyed internally, although the hospital structure was still remaining. And it seemed like, although I know it wasn't the case, but almost a large majority of the population in Gaza had been displaced to Rafah as kind of the last safe place. As I was there, I was present for the beginning of the violence in Rafah and the displacement that happened throughout my time there that May. And at the time when I entered, the only kind of healthcare supplies that we're getting in were on the backs of healthcare workers, like these international teams that were coming through the border crossing. With this siege and closure of Rafah border crossing, we saw fuel, medications, different equipment, and of course, like water, food, any sparse amount that was coming through at that point was completely stopped. And to think now of how much more of a blockade there has been is terrifying. I encountered and interacted with incredibly hardworking and incredibly skilled healthcare workers throughout Gaza who were also just exhausted and under-resourced in so many ways. At this point, the amount of destruction and now like the lack of jobs, even for, there's not even places for healthcare workers to work at this point. I get messages from midwives all the time asking what NGO may be hiring or whatever space, and there's just nothing.
Unbelievable. And now Rafah, I mean, is completely decimated. What are you hearing from your colleagues there? Is the Emirati hospital still at least partially functioning? Is it gone? What do you know?
What I know of Emirati is that there's not much functioning happening there, although I don't think that I have the most up-to-date information on that. Majority of all of the healthcare workers that I knew that were in Rafah at the time, this time last year, have been displaced now to the middle region and were, you know, working kind of at Nasser or trying to get work at Al-Aqsa Hospital in Deir al-Balah. But the functionality of all of the hospitals within the system are like really, you know, compromised. They're are just such a scant amount of hospitals in particular that are able to provide maternity care or any other primary health care. Either hospitals have been decimated and destroyed, there have been forced closures because of evacuation, shelling, and violence, or there have been such horrible circumstances. For example, roads being completely bombed, so cars can't go through, where people are like having to walk, you know, unnecessary amounts of time, especially while pregnant and in labor, to even get to hospitals. And of the hospitals that are still functioning, all of the resources have been shunted to emergency care, which has led to over a year now of women not receiving any prenatal care at all, of so many people with chronic diseases and illnesses and cancers not receiving the treatment that they need. And again, it just catastrophic is the best way to put it. And it's hellish.
Yeah. Yeah. And what can you tell us about your patients, you know, from last year? I mean, are you in touch? Are you able to check in on them? How are your colleagues doing?
Yeah. Nobody is okay. I think that there has just been, I mean, I was an important kind of thing to look at right now. The UN Human Rights Commission just put out this special report on reproductive and sexual violence, gender-based violence since October 7th that has been going on in Palestine. And a review of the report for me feels just like reviewing my journal entries the time that I was in Gaza. My experience directly reflects exactly, you know, what evidence was brought there, which is that there are, you know, 540,000 women of reproductive age in the Gaza Strip, and zero of whom really have adequate care. There's 60,000 pregnant people in Gaza at a time. And there's a targeted killing that is happening to these women as well. 70% of the verified dead have been women and girls, particularly girls between the ages of 5 and 9. So this is just such a destructive attack on all these women and children. And the truth of the matter is that my patients, after having their deliveries and their babies being born, left the hospital within hours without follow-up care, without postpartum care or support, without really resources to have, you know, adequate nutrition or hydration postpartum to breastfeed. I have no clue. I think often about the amount of babies that I saw being born who are no longer alive, you know, within this year. I hope, you know, for all those little beings and souls that they've made it to their first birthday.
Yeah. Yeah. And speaking more about the UN report, the Commission of Inquiry, which found that Israel is committing acts of genocide and crimes against humanity and war crimes, specifically through gender-based violence and the destruction of reproductive health care in Gaza. I mean, there are the IVF clinics that have been bombed, the people's embryos that they were saving to try and build families with, that are completely decimated. What, as a practitioner, as someone who's been caring for women and helping to deliver babies into this world, how do you think the genocide in all of its forms that we're seeing playing out in Gaza, day after day, hour after hour, how has it become so normalized for Israel to be wantonly and brazenly defying and mocking international law at this point? Would I mean, if this Commission of Inquiry report were applied to any other country, I think we would be seeing more, you know, consternation in the so-called international community. What goes through your head? What is the meaning of these kinds of reports and the findings that these reports reveal in this atmosphere of just complete impunity?
I think first and foremost, you know, the reason why these reports exist is because of the healthcare workers that are there. And I'm not just speaking to international healthcare workers, but, you know, local healthcare workers who are really putting their lives on the line in order even to share this information. Because of how, you know, how Israel has cut off any ability for really reporting to happen on the ground, aside from the very brave journalists in Gaza that for some reason nobody's really, it seems to be listening to and with the powers that be. I think that that's the thing that goes through my mind the most. I think it is very clear kind of the depth of Palestinian exceptionalism that exists, you know, within the Western world. And it's disgusting. It is furthermore disgusting how all of these, you know, large international globally recognized healthcare institutions and associations, academic centers have just turned a blind eye to this. And I think that a lot of it has to do with, you know, the fears of fascist crackdowns that are happening within like the Trump administration, along with, and particularly in my case at UCSF, I think donor bases and money funding. It's really disgusting to see such moral corruption in exchange for funding that is happening within these institutions.
Yeah. Well, Bridget, if you could talk about what happened at UCSF and the ways in which you were targeted, and now, you know, your the administration sent a letter of intent to fire you formally. Can you talk about what happened and bring us back to that time right after you returned from Gaza in 2024?
Yeah. So when I returned, the first day that I returned back to work in June of last year, I was carrying a lot with me of what I had seen, of the mothers that I had tried to support, of the healthcare workers that I had tried to, you know, support while being there. I witnessed women being subjected to just horrible conditions in giving birth. And I think most impactfully, being stripped of their dignity, babies being stripped of their dignity of being born into a safe place, and outright violations of reproductive justice, the tenets of which are, you know, the right to choose when or to not have a baby or to build a family, and the right to give birth in a place that is safe and receive healthcare that is safe, and the right to raise your children in a place that is safe. Violations exist across the board here. And as you mentioned, the, you know, IVF center of 4,000 embryos that were destroyed and thousands of more eggs and sperm, you know, samples that were destroyed. The women in Gaza, you know, in this UN Special Report 2 report, 99% of them are struggling with breastfeeding. You know, there's just at every single point a violation of reproductive justice. And as I returned to UCSF, which is an organization that if you browse their website or look at any of their marketing materials, is really focused on, you know, global health and inclusive care and DEI and all of these kind of trigger words that attract people to their healthcare, to their, you know, jobs, I was essentially told that I was being anti-Semitic. For showing up at work wearing a watermelon on my badge. And this came after a long course of back and forth and repression at work. Since December of 2023, I started wearing a keffiyeh at work, which was totally appropriate and within dress code according to my union contract, but per my manager made somebody uncomfortable and so therefore was a violation of my uniform regulations. I dealt with some patients who, you know, made complaints with me and other staff members who were wearing kind of watermelons or any such solidarity symbols for Palestine. And I also experienced a huge amount of patients saying that they felt safer in my care because of what I was wearing and that they were really thankful and thankful for the work that I've done. So when I returned back to UCSF, I was told that, you know, I had to take off the watermelon pin, and it felt like a really big dismissal of what I had seen and like my professional expertise as a medical professional, as an expert in reproductive health. What I witnessed firsthand was a genocide. What I witnessed firsthand was a destruction of healthcare systems and a particular targeting of women's ability to give birth and to take care of their babies. I also know that wearing a watermelon was not something that there's nothing listed on my UCSF uniform contract that said no watermelons. And there'd also been a really longstanding history of pin wearing and accessorizing. And I've seen that at every hospital that I've worked with. You know, we are all wearing the same uniform. And what makes us special is like the little pieces of flair that we have on our badges. And I've worn a Black Lives Matter pin on my badge since I started in healthcare. I've worn an LGBTQ pin since I've started in healthcare. UCSF itself actually manufactures its own LGBTQ UCSF pride pins and distributes them to any staff, student, or healthcare worker there who signs a pride pledge committing to be kind of like an ally and committed to continuing education around gender and queerness and all of these things. And I've never been told to take any of these other things off. So to be told that and to see again this Palestinian exceptionalism like unfold, I decided not to take it off. The other healthcare workers in my clinic who also were wearing them did because of the threat of how scary it was, which I totally understand. And from June on, I've been placed on leave and brought back for maybe a couple of days or a few minutes in one case at a time, only to be placed back on leave again for wearing the watermelon, and have been, you know, charged with this idea that I'm really making it an unsafe work environment, and I'm making it an unsafe place for patients. And it boggles my mind because I work in a fertility clinic, and, you know, for somebody to say that they feel unsafe because I'm wearing a piece of seasonal fruit, essentially, on my badge, while the largest fertility clinic in Gaza is specifically targeted and all of those embryos are gone, is it's absurd.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. And, you know, I mean, UCSF is a top tier teaching facility. It's in the so-called Progressive Bay Area. Like you said, that, you know, they have no problem with pride pins or Black Lives Matter pins. But when it comes to Palestine and speaking up about the genocide that that the U.S. is co-authoring, funding, supporting, encouraging, that's a problem. You mentioned donors, but what else is behind UCSF's actions here? You know, it's part of the UC system, the University of California. The administration of the University of California system has been colluding with the Trump administration to threaten and even deport students across the universities. And for decades, students and faculty groups have been demanding that the UC divest from its holdings in Israel and corporations that are complicit in Israel's occupation and genocide. Tell us how you see the university's actions to target you in particular, but within the broader context here.
I think that what is happening to me is, you know, nothing in comparison to what is happening to other students. I have a lot of privilege in this situation. And I think, though, that it is kind of all connected to this larger pattern of, for example, what's happening to Mahmoud Khalil at Columbia or any other Columbia student who is you know, essentially getting marked for deportation because of speaking out for a ceasefire. I also think that this goes to locally what's happening in San Francisco around the Golden Gate 26. Today marks a 1-year anniversary of these protesters being arrested, and they are still in a drawn out legal battle with felony charges. For blocking a bridge. In a way, bridges have been blocked many times in San Francisco as part of San Francisco history, you know, as early as, you know, in the 80s around the HIV crisis and other things. I think that there is a very, I think it's very becoming very clear that this type of repression in the West is becoming a tool of the genocide that's going on in Palestine. And it is incredibly alarming. And it is really surprising to me, and I guess that it shouldn't be, but to see, you know, so much of these, like, in living in a progressive state, in a progressive city, really hoping that, given the face of like funding cuts versus, again, integrity that you know, administrators, that leadership within the entire UC system wouldn't like kowtow to fascism. Really recently, within the last month, the president of the UC Regents, President Drake, announced that he would be eliminating DEI statements and diversity, like, you know, paragraphs essentially from all job applications. And I mean, we're just seeing this across the board. I think the thing that's really concerning is that, you know, we think about how scary this is now, and how specific it kind of is to these, to certain things, to Palestine, to trans health identity and rights. And I think this is continued exercise in fascism. You know, I think that I'm getting fired now for a watermelon pin, and I think that everybody is next for whatever reason. And it's terrifying. And it's also doing a really good job of shifting our energy away from what is actually happening in Palestine and on the ground, as we are now fighting, you know, to not be deported, to not lose our livelihoods, all of that here in the US.
Yeah. And what about community support? And you're not the only, you know, healthcare provider who has been threatened or who has been fired already over their you know, support of the rights of Palestinians to exist. But what kind of coalitions or movements are building within the healthcare community here in the U.S.? And what does that sort of solidarity and community support look like?
Yeah, it has been, you know, silver lining in all of this has been the mobilization and coalition building around and with healthcare workers who, you know, seem to agree that we all made a decision and took an oath in coming into healthcare that we were here to defend human rights and to advocate for oppressed and marginalized communities who are facing shorter lifespans and more health complications simply due to who they are. I've seen great work that happens within the healthcare workers for Palestine community, both locally here in the Bay Area and internationally. And there has been a lot of coalition building between other organizing groups that have really helped bolster the support. For my campaign specifically, Healthcare Workers for Palestine, which is a group that I'm a part of, has been incredibly supportive and helpful in conjunction with the Right to Reject Zionism and other kind of other groups that are really focused on supporting people in these situations. A petition went out for me to go to the chancellor and executive vice chancellor and provost at UCSF. And today we have 6,500 some odd letters written to these individuals asking for not only my reinstatement, but demanding a divestment in all of these industries of harm. It's, again, absurd that, you know, the UC system, which relies, you know, in many cities is like main medical center, are invested in like military and weapons manufacturers, and to also not accept funding from, you know, funder or donors like the Diller family, for example, who are, you know, sending so much money to Israel and are really involved in lobbying and propaganda against kind of the Palestinian people. And moreover, academic boycotts, you know, there's so much testing and inhumane treatment that happens on Palestinian bodies at the hands of Israeli academics that needs to stop.
Yeah. And we'll link to that petition in the blog post that accompanies this episode. Finally, you know, what's next for you? I mean, you know, in terms of, are you going to back down if UCSF says, yeah, we'll rehire you if you agree to be silent about Palestine? Or, you know, what would be your response to that? And also, what kind of advice do you have for up and coming healthcare workers or aspirational medical students who want to speak up about Palestine? What kind of advice would you give them?
I think it's really important to realize that we are not alone, and that in speaking out, like, your community will come. I feel incredibly grateful for just the people who have come to me, the people with shared values who have really lent their time and effort and energy and support in helping me through this campaign. I will not back down when it comes to UCSF. I think it's incredibly ridiculous that I'm even in this position for, you know, again, wearing a watermelon. And I think that we need to continue this fight. I think that, you know, being a bystander, saying no, backing down now is only going to lead to bigger and scarier things ahead. And, you know, they can fire me, but they can't fire everybody, you know, and they also can't. They can silence me, but they can't, you know, silence the larger voice of this movement, and the really clear intention that we have around securing the dignity, health, and humanity of every human being on this earth. And so I encourage all of, you know, upcoming budding healthcare workers to be brave and to really, you know, use their skills for good. It is clear how important healthcare is. They wouldn't be bombing hospitals and targeting doctors and nurses and ambulance drivers if it wasn't. One of the most impactful things that I noticed when I was in Gaza was that the hospital, Emirati and Al-Aqsa as well, were the two hospitals that I went to that were the nucleus of the community in this time of complete strife and tragedy and displacement. It's where people were able to plug in their bread makers to make their food. It's where people were able to charge their cell phones and get access. It was where women went who were living in a crowded UN school next door where there was only a few bathrooms to relieve themselves and to try to clean up, you know. And it is the hub of where all of the reporting is. It's where all of Al Jazeera's reporting from are these hospitals. And it's just very clear. And it is really, truly our job to support our colleagues internationally throughout all of this and to support our colleagues here.
Bridget Rochios, you are a midwife and a women's health nurse practitioner. Thank you for all the work that you do. Thank you for your hands and for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you.
Thank you.